Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
So I'm here today with Michael Taylor, some may know as Shifting Shares, and we're picking up the young investor theme that we started with Ryan, the teenage investor. Michael's in his 20s and is a full-time trader and also writes for Investors Chronicle, ShareScope, and has written books and also runs courses. Michael, thanks very much indeed for joining us here today.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about how you got involved in investing.
So I was always interested in investing because I think it was around 2008. And I remember seeing an article about Northern Rock.
And how old were you at that time?
So I would have been 17 or 18.
Yeah.
And it excited me, the idea that you can make large amounts of money trading. And I studied history at university because I enjoyed that more. Eventually, I took a business master's and I'd saved up a lot of money from various jobs. And I put this into a FTSE 100 tracker, found the returns not quite that exciting, and decided to get into penny stocks, where I lost money, as everyone does, and decided this isn't very fun and I wanted to learn how to actually do it. Because one thing I'd noticed, I put some money into Pia TV, which was an absolute dog, went bust, but the volatility on the thing had moved by quite a bit that some people will have done really well on it. And I thought, well, I'd like to be one of those people one day. So that was how that was what drew my interest. Also, I wanted to make my money back as well.
And how did you teach yourself?
So I think history helped in that way because you learn how to research and read books. You learn quite quickly what's true and what isn't, and you can question the source. So I basically went on a deep dive of reading tons of books. Found them really helpful, looked at videos, YouTube videos. I mean, there's a surprising amount of knowledge that's online for free, and I guess I took advantage of it.
And are you unusual in your peers? Do you find that many of your friends of your age are interested in investing?
No, nobody is interested in investing, so it's good to go to events like Mellow, where I can meet people like yourself and other people who are interested in shares, because nobody really is.
And why do you think that is?
I think the 2008 crash took a lot of people out of the market. So even now, people will tell me that shares are gambling and shares, they can go really bad. But if you apply sound investment principles, you can beat the market, or you can at least beat inflation, which if you keep all of your cash in a bank account, you're going to be punished. You are actually going to lose. With the time value of money, that money will go down in value. So I think investing is really good for that.
So when you talk to your friends of a similar age and say that to them, what sort of response do you get?
Well, I think with people my age, the first big decision is the house. So people tend to want to get that sorted before they move on to more risky investments, which I actually think it's the opposite. I think houses are a bit more risky because you have to put so much capital into them and you can never get your money out. You've got to pay huge fees to sell. Whereas with shares, you can, if you pick the right share, you can get in and out quite easily. But I think people want to get the house sorted and they want to feel a bit stable rather than renting, which in a sense you're paying someone else's mortgage. So I think as people move, after they've bought a house, they move into the 30s, then start to think, well, actually, I'm retiring in 30 years and maybe I need to get this sorted.
So for you in your journey, you started off with penny shares and then you did a lot of research. And how long did it take for you to know enough to start outperforming the market and you're now full time, so when did you feel confident enough to go full time? You know, what was the time trajectory?
Well, I was really lucky because I took a few months out, came back in early 2016, and the market then was crazy. There were so many shares just going up. It didn't really matter if they were any good. If they had a story, people would buy them. So I got lucky in that sense that I was able to turn a small amount of money into something a bit more meaningful, purely on the basis of these terrible stocks. And I wouldn't be able to do it now because the market's not really like that. But 2016 and 2017 were fantastic years. And 2017, it was December 2016 where I went full-time on the market, did very well, and of course overextended myself and lost a huge amount of money. And it was at that point that I started to think more methodically about what I'm doing in terms of risk to reward, rather than just sort of picking story stocks and riding them upwards, which was my strategy. And it worked for some time until it didn't.
So how long was your education process and how long before you went full time?
Probably about 9 months. And I'm still
so pretty quickly
today. Yeah, but as I say, it was the market in a sense, because unlike people who might have a high-flying career, to then take a step back from that and become a full-time investor, I think must be quite scary. But I wasn't earning much money at the start of my career, so it was, you know, I could always go back to it. So it wasn't really that much of a risk, if that makes sense.
And when you lost a lot of money, did that make you then think, gosh, I better go back to the day job?
Well, I lost a lot of money, but I was still well up.
Okay.
But it did make me think, like, Michael, if you carry on doing this, you're going to go back to the day job. And that really scared me.
Yeah.
It scared me how much you could actually lose.
Yeah.
Because I was levered on a lot of stuff as well, trash basically. And when the general election happened, liquidity in small caps and micro caps fizzled out. So I would have had to sell into my own flow to actually get out of the position. And I didn't have any exit plan in place. So every week I was down more and more, just staring at the losses. I didn't sell. 7 a.m. I'd be dreading it because the market would open in an hour. And I knew I was probably going to lose, but I didn't sell. So I made all the classic errors later. So whereas people normally do it at the start, I didn't, made a lot of money, but then I had that education, which everyone in the market has at some point. And then you either learn or you quit. And I decided to hang in there, and I'm quite glad that I did.
So now, today, what sort of returns are you trying to make per annum? What works for you?
If I can get 20 to 30% a year, then I'm quite pleased. And Warren
Buffett, we all would be.
gets 19 and look how well he's done.
Yeah.
And if you look at a compound trajectory, as long as you don't lose that much and you can earn 10, 20, 30% a year, you can do very well. So when I was younger, it would be 100%. And also it was from a small base. With oversized positions, but now it's a lot more conservative. So a lot of the time last year, my portfolio was actually in cash and I'll nip in and out of positions. So it's a lot more active and I certainly have to work for those returns, but I'm never putting myself at huge amounts of risk. So that to me is the most important thing, because if I can carry on doing what I'm doing, then eventually it can grow into quite a substantial sum.
So what is your strategy? How do you get these fantastic returns?
It changes a lot. So 2017, it will be buy momentum and buy the dip. That stopped working, so I stopped doing it. I focused on breakouts quite a lot. And when the market turns, it'll be breakdowns. At the moment, it's gap and news-based trades. And I will still target breakouts on significant levels. I think when you're trading, when the market changes, you've got to change as well, because if you don't, then it just won't work. And you see that in investing as well. So momentum investing has been very popular over the last decade. There'll come a time when that changes and momentum investors will underperform, maybe. But for now, it seems to be going pretty well.
So with November, December 18, the market obviously sold off a lot.
Yeah.
Did you manage to make money at that time?
I did quite well, yeah. So I tend to outperform when there's periods of high volatility, because I'm actively searching for ways to profit from that volatility. So when markets are flat, it's quite hard for me to make any money because you need things to move up or down. Otherwise, you're just holding things and they're not really working. Since the Boris bounce in December, we had a lot of trading updates in January. It was a good month because things were sort of moving freely. The spreads were narrower. You could get in and out a lot easier. Because we spoke before about AIM shares, you know, if the spread is 10%, well, you've got to make the spread. And then if you want to make 10% as well on top of that, really, you've got to make 20. So you have to have a high probability entry. Otherwise, you'll just churn your account in spread, which is no good.
So how long is the normal time that you hold a share for?
It really depends. So I bought something this morning and I sold it because it was a big seller. I didn't like it, so I got out. If that had started to rise gently, I might have held it for a few days or a couple of weeks. It really depends on what the trade is. When I short, I tend to hold things, get rid of them very quickly because the volatility is higher. For example, Sirius Minerals is a stock where it'll move quite quickly if there's any action in it. So to the short side, it can be quite profitable if you short it, but it will snap back right up. So you do have to be careful when shorting.
So presumably you have to sit in front of your screen all of the time.
A lot of the time, yeah. I mean, if I'm heavy in the market, then I will, because I don't like to have stops so much in the market because I'm convinced that people know where they are. So it'll be a mental stop instead. So I might have a level 2 or I might have an alert that pops up on my screen where the bid is this, and then I might call the broker and get out rather than have an actual stop in the market. But if I'm not so much in the market and I've just got a few positions, then it's less important. But it is hard work.
So being here now, we're in trading hours. Mm-hmm. What do you do with any of your positions? Do you put stops on them or?
I don't. And sometimes I think that I should. So for example, Ixico, I closed that position this morning. Simon Thompson said to take profits. So it's down 15%. Now, if I'd had a stop much closer, then I would have got out at a better level, but I prefer not to do that because I find if you often have a stop near the price will find that stop. And there was a time when I was in Future Group, my stop was way below the actual price, and yet somehow it gapped down, took my stop out, and rose back up. And I was thinking, how do they know that? So I'm convinced that people know about stops. And we had the market maker on before, and there was a market maker at Mello as well, and he said basically don't use stops.
Oh, interesting.
So that confirmed what I think I know.
What's your view on market makers and the retail investor?
Well, they've got a job to do, provide liquidity. They definitely do what they can get away with, because a lot of the time, if you want to buy online, you won't be able to buy at NMS, so the normal market size or exchange market size, I think it's called now. And when you want to sell, they might often not provide a proper bid, so you have to call up your broker and try and get out. But if that's a fast-moving stock, you've got to be quick.
And you do most of your trading by actually speaking to the broker?
I prefer to, yeah. Unless it's set, you can sort of use IG's direct market access platform and put your trades actually on the book. But if it's a set QX or a market maker stock, I think it is better to have a phone broker.
And how many trades will you generally do in a week, typical week?
It depends. It might be, could be anything from 5 to 10 in a day if I'm busy, or it could be none. So I'm basically on the hunt for trades, and if there's no trades, I don't try and force it or don't try and bully the market.
Isn't that the most difficult thing, to sit on your hands if you're wanting to trade?
It can be, and boredom trading used to be quite a big problem for me, so I would look for trades. I'd have that bias where I'd want to buy something, so I'd look for a reason to buy something. And when I printed actually all of my trades off, and look through them, and I could just see how much money I was losing because I was just jumping into things for, you know, out of boredom. And, you know, if you're going to make this a living, it's you're effectively gambling. And I don't really want to gamble. I want to actually make money. So that I had to stop. But it can be hard. But I guess if you can't cut out the boredom trades, then you probably shouldn't be trading.
So what's your day in the life of a trader? When do you get up? How long are you standing and sitting in front of a screen? What are you looking for and how do you spend your day?
So if you're
not talking to me.
Yeah, so I get up generally quite early, about 5:30. And when I'm at home, I'll go in my gym in the garage, or I'll go for a run or a walk, just sort of sharpen the mind a bit. What I used to do is I'd get up at 6:45 and sort of roll up at 7 at my terminal, you know, sort of get the sleep out my eyes, have a coffee, and I'd be scrolling through the RNSs. And you just can't really do that if you want to actually do this. There's some incredibly smart people out there, which are the people who you're playing against. So you do have to be ready. So we'll go to the gym, get myself ready. Come 7 o'clock, the RNS feed starts rolling. Pick out some interesting RNSs. Start building a plan about how I'd trade them. Go over my checklist, get ready for the auction at 7:50. Open up tickets. If I want a deal, I'll get on the phone to a broker and manage the trades from there.
And you're pretty much in front of your screen until 4:30.
It can be like that if it's a busy day. Very often, I usually try and shut things down around 12. So I do a bit of writing now as well. And if there's no trades, I just won't trade.
And how big a part do you think psychology is in trading?
I think everything. I think that if you can't master your psychology, you will really struggle. Because what a lot of people struggle to do, and I also struggled with this, is to cut losses. So when someone says, I'll take a trade in this stock, it goes down 10%, but then they'll think, oh, well, you know, it's going to go back up eventually. And they might even have an investing position in the stock. So that trade is then compartmentalized into an investment, which is the biggest sin if you are a trader, because you're going to cut those wins quite quick, but you have to cut the losses quicker. So I think if you can't manage that and get the idea of cutting losses, then you will struggle. And you also have to not get scared. So sometimes if I take a rather big loss, it puts me back a bit. I start to get scared to pull the trigger, but you have to just keep on going. I heard a story, it was Trader Dante, who said he had 5 loss-making months in a row, and that must be tough. But he said he continued because he knew that over time his strategy worked. So you have to have that belief in that what you are actually doing works and continue to do it even if you have losing weeks or even losing months.
So what is your strategy? What's your winning formula?
Breakouts work. People have been talking about this strategy for decades and it still works. So if the market was efficient, would it work? Well, it does. Post earnings drift is a well-known about phenomenon where a company will release good results. Now, in theory, it would gap up the uncrossing trade would be the sort of high of the day, but very often these stocks will continue upwards and you can trade that. So I look for ahead statements. A good one recently has been Dunelm, the home furnishings. Very often they'll release a good trading statement. It'll be ahead and it'll gap up and it'll continue. Greggs as well has been fantastic. And these are sets, large stocks. So you can get in with some size. You can also get out quite quickly as well if it goes
wrong. And
you'll
buy in first thing?
Yeah, I'll buy in first thing or I'll put an order in for the auction. Yeah.
From what I've read of one of your books, actually planning the trade. So calculating what risk you're taking and knowing where you're going to get out, both on the up and on the down, is a critical part to your strategy. Could you explain a bit more?
Yeah. So my worst trades will be when I buy something, but I don't know when I'm getting out. And I prefer to know where I'm getting out because, one, you can look at your actual risk, so you know the maximum loss in monetary terms on the trade, and also percentage. Because if you don't know where you're getting out, then how do you know where you're ever going to get out? I mean, either you'll close the position or the market will pull the stock down so much, you get to that capitulation stage that the stock is really closing you. So you either close it on your terms or on someone else's terms. So I think it's always better to close things on your own terms, because I've done it before where I've ran a loser, and typically you print, you know, the low of the day, it snaps back up and you think, well, why did I do that? But of course, it should have been cut a lot earlier.
So are all the decisions that you make based on technical analysis? You're not looking at fundamentals at all?
A lot of them, yeah. So a lot of them will be technical based, but if you can find a stock that's fundamentally good and it's got the right technical strength, then that can be a very powerful signal. And this is something Mark Minervini looks at in his books as well. So he'll actively look for stocks where the top line is increasing and accelerating, and he's got the technical setup as well. But of course, you can trade anything if it's got the right setup. But generally, I like to trade stage two stocks, which will be the uptrending ones. And that's where the institutions are buying. So things like Games Workshop has been a fantastic example, which many people have done really well on getting
in
early.
Is that moving into phase three now, we have to ask ourselves?
Maybe. I haven't checked the chart recently, but that has been a fantastic return. And when the institutions start to sell, I would think that that is probably the time to take profits. So we saw that on Burford last year. You could see that the stock was selling off on very good results. It would gap up and it would get sold off, high volume, institutions selling, and it eventually turned out Muddy Waters Research had a short position as well. So, I mean, the warning signs were there if you look for them, because no one could have really predicted that that would have happened and it ended up crashing 80%. But you can certainly spot signs of distribution and people selling based on the candles and the volume.
And do you have any investing side to your money management? Do you have any pot allocated to investing as against trading?
No, not at the moment. I would like to get to that stage, but I know that my strategy in trading works. And if I just continue to do that, eventually, yeah, I would like to find really good stocks. Obviously, Games Workshop has done fantastically well if you just bought it and then didn't sell. And those stocks like that are ones that I would like to own in the future, because I don't just want to be trading all the time. It is fun, but it's hard work. And I think it's a lot easier if you can find a really good company, stick with the story, don't get shaken out. But that's for the future.
And many would argue that you can't time the market, but you're defying that. How are you managing that?
Charts. I think the chart tells you everything necessary about a stock. I mean, you can't exactly time it, but it does give you an edge that if you can clearly see like a chart that's flatlining, yet every time it dips, there's a lot of high volume and the price pulls back up, you can clearly see that there is a buyer in the market. Or if there's a consistently high bid or level two, you might have an algo jumping up ahead of you trying to get filled. So you can get clues. But, you know, if I could time the market, I wouldn't be speaking to you. I'd be sat in the Caribbean. So I can't. And I don't think anybody can. I think it's just something people like to say.
But as a trader, that's exactly what you're endeavouring to do.
I try to, yeah. I try to find opportunities where I might be right 5, 6, 7 times out of 10, but my risk will be lower than my reward, if that makes sense. So you basically tilt the odds in your favour and just play that edge over and over again, and that's where I hope to make money by doing so.
Do you think that every investor should have a trading part of their portfolio?
That is a good question. Some people, yes. I think some people are clever enough, certainly, to manage both, especially with the knowledge they have about companies. They can identify really good companies. So I think if they put that with a technical aspect, then they could definitely have a profitable trading account as well. The difficulty is, as I said earlier, letting those two sides switch. They have to be completely independent, and that might mean cutting a loss on a stock that is actually your favourite stock. But definitely, I think many investors could do that, yeah.
And don't you find liquidity an issue? I know we've touched on it, mm-hmm. but as you get more and more successful, your position sizes are going to get larger and larger.
Yeah.
Then it's more challenging to get in and out in the way that you might want to.
It is, yeah. So I think that's one of the advantages of having a phone broker, because the market makers will very often deal 2, 3, 4 times NMS, whereas online you might only be able to sell 200 quid, which is not really much use. But yeah, gradually, as position sizes get bigger, you need to find bigger stocks, really. So that's why I enjoy trading set stocks, because you can often get in or out a lot easier.
And do you trade US stocks at all?
No, I probably should, but it's a lot to learn, and I feel like I'm starting to understand the UK market, and that would be doing something completely new. But I have seen the volatility on some of those things, and yeah, I think probably I should learn in the future.
So in your opinion, what factors play against the retail investor when they're trading?
I think everything. The AIM market isn't really that well regulated. Frauds do happen. Investor cash gets sucked away. The nomads probably aren't as on the ball as they should be, because obviously they're paid by the company. So they're paid by the very person that they're supposed to oversee. So there is a conflict of interest there. Brokers, again, will put out research and also raise money. And some of them will have market-making desks as well. Now, there's supposed to be Chinese walls. I don't really think that it's enforced as much as it could be all the time. Insider trading obviously goes on. So with Sirius Minerals, there was a huge volume spike and a price rise. And the next day, the takeover offer was announced. So what are the chances of that happening? And we see that quite a lot. Stocks will start to drift before a profit warning or a placing's released. With these AIM companies that are reliant on cash, the broker might send a mass email asking, do you want to be made inside? And that might go out to a few thousand people. And one person might meet a friend down the pub, tell a friend about this company doing a placing. They then sell all the shares, ticks it down a couple of percent, and people follow that. So I think you have to be careful, because the FCA are either overstretched or underfunded. We see very little actually happen. In the case of Sirius Minerals, a lot of shareholders now are feeling aggrieved, because they feel like they've been promised a lot and it's not really come to fruition for a lot of them. So I think just be careful, and just don't assume that what you were actually seeing is the truth. Always question the motive behind it, what's really going on, because I don't think that the market is very fair, especially for private investors. And that is something that I would like to start to change. And I think ShareSoc would also like to see changes as well, because if we see continued abuse of the market, one, it's going to scare investors away, so we'll see less people come to the market. And secondly, companies just don't want to list anymore. So there's been a trend in the last year. We've seen a lot less companies come to the market and a decline in the number of companies listed. And that's obviously not great.
And have you been stung at all by any of these sort of dodgy dealings?
Plenty. Too many to count. But it's very difficult to prove. But if you're aware of those risks, you can start to mitigate against them. So if you think about what can happen when you take a position, then you can start to plan and defend against it.
But you might never invest in anything.
That's true. You've got to take a chance. I suppose you've got to be in it to win it, I suppose.
So not mentioning any names, but can you give an example of what happened when you got caught by one of these situations?
There was an RNS that came out that was later corrected and turned out to be something completely false. And I think the Nomad should have been on that and checked. They didn't. Again, I think because of the reason they don't really work that hard, as long as it, and they've got an interest in looking the other way as well because they're being paid by the company. But that has happened to me a lot of times. It's just an occupational risk of the market, I suppose. There's not much you can do about it.
What more do you think we can do to encourage more young people to invest?
I think that's a good question. And again, I think it's a generational thing. So people my age don't necessarily invest until they've got some money. But really, if you think about the power of compounding, it's actually best done the sooner you start. Because if you can make 10% on a few thousand and eventually grow that, you don't necessarily need to have tens of thousands to start investing. And it's probably better that you do it sooner, because when you make the mistakes, they're not as sizable in monetary terms. But I think it's something that should be taught in schools, definitely, about long-term investment, whether that's in housing or equities, because I didn't get taught anything about that at all. In maths, we learnt about the radii of circles and trigonometry, and I've just never used that in my life. I used some basic equation stuff in corporate finance, but even with that, you've got calculators and spreadsheets that do it all for you. So I think it should be taught in schools. And I think the government could do more to promote ISAs as well, because people don't realise that whatever you make in an ISA is actually tax-free. And that advantage isn't really pushed that hard.
So what advice do you have for a young person listening to you now?
Get started, but don't jump in with everything. What a lot of people tend to do, and a mistake I made as well, is put large amounts into single stocks. Whereas if you spread it across 10 or 20 stocks, if one does go badly, it's not going to harm you as much. Or even just get started with a tracker fund or a good fund manager. Just something to take the first step, because you can always learn as you go along. But if you're in the market for 30 years, it doesn't really matter if you're starting off with a large amount of money. If you are successful, and tracker funds have always increased in the long run, there's no guarantee that they will continue to do so, obviously. But if they do, you can actually turn small amounts of money into something much more substantial.
And if people want to learn more from you and more about you, where do they find you?
They can go on my website on shiftingshares.com. I've got a free UK stock market book, which covers the basics, a trading handbook as well, which goes through some of the risk management and position sizing things that I use in the market, and two handbooks on trading breakouts and breakdowns as well.
And you're just about to start running courses, aren't you?
I would like to run courses eventually again. Yeah, so I ran a couple last year and they were quite successful. I'm going to do that again in the future.
And you're writing for Investors Chronicle?
Investors Chronicle, Money Week, ShareScope. So my articles are on there if you search them, yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed for your time. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Thank you, Tamsin. Thanks for having me.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.